as long as I can remember. Here.
What would you say were the mill's most prosperous years?
Well, I would think that it was along in the 20s to 30s, and then maybe 41 through 46 or 7. That was the time, see, when lumber had been taken, the last one, when lumber had been taken by the war efforts and all. And it lapped over after the war was over. They still needed it.
Did you find the 50s very prosperous?
Well, the 50s, I think, in more super, we had a great deal of lumbering and so forth, so that maybe through 52 to 53, that part of it was very much so. And then after that, for a while, it just seemed as if it was, well, of course, our sawmill burned, and there was a few things that hurt at that time, you know. That after that, too, there were more other mills and different retail lumber yards and things that set up that would, because the number of people in this part of the country was limited, and so when you have more competition, you naturally had to work harder to get it.
Did the mill start a slow decline after the planing mill burned?
Yes, I think so, some. At that time, of course, we had to take our whole stock to Plattsburgh to have it dressed. Everything that was dried and drying out. And so that cost money, you know, cost a lot of extra hauling and extra labor. But it was all taken care of and all. And then after that, I think that about that time that the prices of lumber and so forth went up. At certain times, we would get a great deal of demand, and then it depended upon other sources of income around whether or not the building was something that could be deferred until later if it had to be. I mean, it wasn't like food. You didn't have to do it then. You could wait for something.
Right. Did you have to hire extra men to take your lumber to Plattsburgh to be planed?
And trucks and so forth, because it took at least a day to go over and have it milled and come back and with each truck, and so that would limit your delivering activity.
What mill did you contract with in Plattsburgh?
Mason and Sons in Peru. Well, it was really in Peru, and the one that offered it. That's where their mill was.
Did they do all the things you had done here on Elm Street?
They had everything there in the same line.
So you continued to have planing done with them until the mill ended?
Yes. Right.
Do you think your business could have survived without the paint, nails, brushes, hardware, things like that that you sold?
No. I think as we grew, the variety, because what you did when a customer came in for lumber, you also wanted to sell him everything else that was connected with the building of the building to make a profit on that too. So I don't think you could have survived without having, in a, mainly a retail business, without having the other items to sell also.
Was there ever a time when you think the mill could have survived without these extra things, like in the early years?
For instance, as it did in the earlier days, I mean, a hardware store sold hardware, and like Sears Roebuck didn't sell hardware or any of the other stores. It was mainly each store sold their special item without lapping over into the other one. But that was discontinued long ago.
Was there ever a time under the Bowen mill that you didn't sell anything but wood? Ever a time when your father owned the mill that he sold nothing but wood?
Well, like up at Scary, except for the store, being that was really there was nothing, only just what we manufactured ourselves. That was all that was sold there.
Was most of the money earned at the mill put back into the mill running?
Well, there was always a certain drawing account of partners, and a good deal of it was kept in the mill, but except for the drawing account. And then if anything, if they had paid off notes and so forth, then they would divide, you know, the difference to keep. The idea was that they didn't want to sew it all up in the mill if they didn't have to.
Could you explain what a drawing account was?
I can't remember back, of course, in the 20s and so forth, it was much less. I can't remember what their drawing accounts were.
No, but could you explain what it was? Could you explain what it was? What kind of an operation a drawing account
is? Oh, it was when the men were paid each week, the partners also drew out so much. Like the payroll was made out, they took it up at the bank, and the men were paid in cash. And then the partners in the company, like when it was Mr. Wilding and Dad, they drew out so much. And then when it was Dad alone, and then Dad took in my brother and myself as partners. And so that each week the drawing account was used. And that kept you on a current basis. There wasn't something that you owed, that you would use the money for something else and hadn't taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Were you and your brother taken in as partners in the same year, the same date?
No, Dad bought from Mr. Wilding in 26, and then we were taken in as partners in 1946.
But you 20. Were both taken in the same year?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did the business change any after you were taken in?
Well, after the war, there was certain things that we took in that we didn't have before, which was about the same time. For instance, we sold General Electric oil burners. We had a man and sold and serviced those for quite a few years. And then the General Electric oil burner, which was one of the very best made, was also one of the most complicated and had to be taken care of by an expert. And then all of the oil companies who furnished oil started selling oil burners. And by that time they had been made simpler, that was the idea, and still so that we just eliminated selling the oil burners after our mill man, I think he was killed in 1958, if I remember correctly. And then when he was gone, we just stopped selling them. Although we serviced for a long while after his death, we serviced the ones that we had sold. And we still have one in our office that was installed there in 1926. So they were wonderful oil burners.
Mm-hmm. Did you and your brother try and bring about any changes once you were partners?
Oh, yes. I think that you had new ideas that kept coming up. And for instance, at one time, we had thought of starting an appliance store and so forth in a different part that would maybe have a showroom uptown and then have our stock at the lumber company, but somewhere to have people see it and then want to come after it. But that project was abandoned. There were too many people who were in that same business too.
I see.
We didn't want to invest our money in something that wasn't going to move fast enough to make a profit on, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other changes you and your brother tried to put through?
Well, quite a few years we did more contracting. Because my brother was away during the war years, he was in the army, and so that when he came back and it released more time, we could watch over different contracts that we did. We weren't big contractors, but we would take contracts when one was free to take care of the work that we contracted for, like building a barn or a house or different things like that.
Did you and your brother get along with the employees well?
I think so. We tried to. In other words, if you don't have people, like, they never do the best work unless they enjoy being working for you. I think that's true. Uh-huh. So that we always tried to.
Mm-hmm. Could they get a discount on lumber, employees?
Oh, yes. We always gave our employees a 20% discount, which is really down at cost. More than cost, because you didn't make that much percentage, you know, for the...
So the prices set by the mill yard were 15 to 20% higher than cost?
No, it was usually set from 33 and a third to 40% higher than the cost of the material. But then when you took out your cost of operation, and then on small yards, you would make from 6 to 12%. You should make 12%, but you didn't always on your investment. And at big lumber yards, at certain times, they would only be making 1 and 2% net. You wouldn't believe it, would you? Their operation was so large that 1 or 2% helped them. But now, they wouldn't take care of that because they could get more help living their money in a bank. But at that time, there wasn't as much the other way.
Did you have to raise your prices during slow years or slow seasons?
The prices, of course, they fluctuated according to demand and according to... Now, for instance, if they would have a very severe winter on the West Coast, and then the snow would melt, and they would have to shut down for 2 or 3 months, those big mills, or they couldn't get into the woods with their big trucks, that would... send the price of lumber up, and it would affect us. It would affect us a little later than it would out there, because we had to buy 3 or 4 months ahead. But and you didn't usually raise your lumber or anything in the yard until the new price came in. And you waited until the last minute so to keep it down where you could.
Mm-hmm. If people around here were buying very slowly, what would you do to your prices? Would you raise them or lower them?
They would, yes, sometimes you would have a special price to try to move your stock. If you had a large stock of shiplap or something like that and was buying it slowly, you'd try to get it so that you could turn your money over or get your money back and maybe buy something that they needed more, if they needed shingles more or something that was necessarily had to use whether they wanted to or not. For a roof, and that's what you do. You give them a special. And at one time, we had a special every week in advertising. You kept using different things, and maybe on Thursday, which we had a Thursday night opening, we would have a special that day on the shiplap, we'll say. It would maybe be $10 a thousand cheaper. Or we might have it on a certain length of 2x4s that were moving slowly. And we didn't, we tried to have them come into the yard to find what the special was rather than advertising the special, what it was, to have get them there. Because you always figure that if you get people into your store or yard, that they may see something else that they want. Right.
So what form did your newspaper advertisements take? They didn't usually take the form of a listing of values.
Certain things you listed, and certain items that you had special from a wholesale company, you gave that. And then if there was any new items on the market, you tried to tell your customers about those. And then we would have maybe in the, back in the classified ads, we'd have a little special ad for that week, for the what that was. You tried to have people look for ads, in other words, and look at them. Some people can go right through a whole page and see every ad, a whole paper, and then somebody else, unless they're looking for some particular thing, don't read them. And that, you want to get that person to reading your ads. Attention getters, I think.
Aside from your one slogan, did you have any other catchphrases or tricky ways of getting people to take notice?
Oh, yes. When you found that a certain item wasn't selling fast, you always put that on and you got out while people could see it. In other words, you tried to keep a good turnover all the time. So that, because you could get used to seeing things in a certain place and not notice that it wasn't moving out if you weren't careful, so that you had to keep watching four items that were slow movers.
Mm-hmm. What was most typically a slow mover?
Well, I think that maybe certain types of windows. You had a large window and door stop, and there might be a certain type that was needed a great deal this year, and yet the next year something new would have taken its place. And so we said, now for instance, you'll take at one time casement windows that where you made the frames and the casement windows opened in and shut, and they were very good over the sinks. But those same casement windows were colder than a double hung windows, we call one that goes up and down. Well, casement windows were displaced by the new thermopane awning window that opened out with a lever or a turn, and yet it was just as warm when it was closed because they had the new weather stripping, the metal weather stripping. And so those, maybe we had some that were 10 or 12 years old, certain sizes that were in stock that you couldn't send back to the company because they didn't want them, and yet nobody wanted that particular size.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other items, but I mean, more or less it was millwork that had done it. Or maybe a certain type of door had sold for years, and then the customers all wanted another kind. They wanted, see, doors and windows used to be put in frames and put in. And then in the later years, they came already hung, as we called them, inside doors and windows. You would be already, the jam would be cut, split, and you just separate it and put your casings in, and just the whole door would already be hung. You slide in this side and have it meet on the other side and put your stop over it. And a 20-minute operation took the place of maybe 3 to 4 hours. So that, and it could be done much faster at the mill, where that one operation was being done, that was the one that was being done, that size and that operation, then a carpenter could take and put it in your house and make it less expensive.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever sell much mahogany or walnut or expensive exotic wood like that?
Just in plywood mostly, and just a very few boards. We'd have, maybe we'd always have one or two or three items of boards, widths and lengths and so forth, for special orders. You might have it come when you had a carload come in from somewhere, or even a truckload, or smaller items, just a few boards come in to supply somebody. Mm-hmm. Or you might order it special from one of your millwork companies who would keep it in to make doors or windows. They might also sell you a few boards if you just need them for a special order.
What did people use that wood for around here?
Mahogany? Well, I know, for instance, I remember down at Ray Topman's. He was doing a recreation room over, and he was using mahogany paneling, and he wanted mahogany casings and so forth, and mahogany for a set of bookshelves to match the paneling. So it was really an item that was used to match something else. Or somebody might be building a fireplace and want a walnut mantle. They just like that particular wood to go or to be in that certain place. And so they would want maybe a 2-inch plank that was 12 inches wide and maybe 6 feet long or longer if they had bookcases on each side for that. So it was just a little specialty items.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they were beautiful woods finished. They were lovely. And there were different kinds of mahogany there, what we call Lawan mahogany, which is much, much cheaper than the real Afghan mahogany. The Japanese have manufactured a great deal of mahogany for plywood and other things, mostly plywood lately. And it's what we call Lawan mahogany. And it's pretty, but it doesn't have the same grain or texture of the other Afghan mahogany.
Hmm.
And Lawan mahogany is one of the cheapest plywoods that you can buy now. And yet it's very good looking, but it was in large quantity it can be manufactured, and it's softer than the other mahogany, and it grows faster so that they can send it in. Mm-hmm. The Japanese can find things where other people can't.
Did you ever have much trade in Northern New York cherry or other cherry?
Northern New York what?
Cherry.
Cherry? Oh, yes. We always kept cherry. It's very, very beautiful, you know. And we always, every tree that would come in, I mean, it would be sawed out and kept, and it always sold. We had one warehouse that was upstairs, and that warehouse was all hardwood lumber, like our own. Maybe we had some oak for our own, and our cherry, and maple, and birch. Just items, again, like a fireplace mantel, or maybe you were going to do one room all in cherry casings and baseboards, maybe paneling on your ceiling, and things like that. Mm-hmm. But Northern New York cherry was very much in demand always.
How about teak wood? Did you ever carry that?
We've had it in, but not as wasn't a great deal of demand or anything for it. I don't know how we happen to have. We've had a few boards, but nothing to brag about at all.
Mm-hmm. There's been a revolution in the amount and quality of paneling.
Yes. Uh huh. Mm-hmm. That has been one of the biggest things. It has done so much for homes and camps and everything because of labor costs again. Because that can be come in all finished. See, nearly all of the paneling that's used in homes now is already finished. And it costs so much less, and yet it's so much better than it could be done by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. It is, they're also using that. Again, so they use narrower casings so that casings in a room don't attract your attention as much as they used to. They used to detract from the walls and everything. See, now those are so wide and all that you see them more. Well, now the casings are very much narrower, and they even bring the plywood over to them so that it all blends more.
Those are sculptured almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, again, they get away from using the different moldings around because it takes time to moiter the corners and things, and that isn't necessary. You can bring out beauty in other ways.
Your fancy work on the casings is called what? Moiter?
It's what?
What did you call the fancy work around the edges of casings?
Oh, well, those are moldings that are used there.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That was done with the same saw as did the beveling?
Uh-huh. Those were put through a molding machine. And the knives were set up, for instance, to make, we would call that a picture mold that was used in that particular place. And the machine would be set up for that. Maybe there'd be 5,000 or 10,000 feet all put one through. Then if you wanted another base molding that had a different shape, the same knives would be used but changed to make that other pattern and sent through like that.
Mm-hmm. Was it done in the same shop as the beveling?
Mm-hmm. It would be not the same saw. No, it would be a different machine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would be a molding machine.
Did the Bowen Lumber Company own any property in Malone other than its own mill property?
No, Dad owned the property right across the road. There was a where the Parrish Oil Company had the things, and they owned Wilding and Boyne owned all of the houses and built them across from the Bowen Lumber Company and the Malone Concrete Products. Those houses there were built at different times when maybe it was a little slow and you'd send your men over and have them work on the house until you needed them somewhere else because it was just handy to have.
So those houses were owned by the Bowen Mill?
Yes, uh-huh.
And they were rented out?
Uh-huh.
Did you ever have any trouble with your renters?
Well, no. Usually they worked there. And then afterwards the houses were all sold to Shania. He bought the houses, and then the rest of the land, where the Parish Oil Company trucks those other lots there, we rented to the Parish Oil Company because they had their tanks and there was the siding in. And those were just, that land was just sold last week. Just barely sold it.
Were those company houses in the strict sense of the word?
No. They were, as I say, they were just built and rented, not necessarily to anybody who worked in the company, but they, some of them did. It was just whoever had them. They were well-built homes, and but of course the location directly across from mills and so forth wouldn't demand as high rent as somewhere else. Down near the, all the railroads, at that time there was a lot of traffic on the railroads.
Right. What year were they built? Can you remember?
It was in the 20s, because I know that they were all built when there was, when Charlie Welding and sold out to Dad.
Can you remember what rents would be charged?
No, but I mean, not exactly, but I would think that would probably been around $20 to $25 a month. Just remembering what it was at that time.
Did you rent those houses until the mill closed?
No. They were sold out to a Carl Shanyo, and a long while ago, I've forgotten. I should say maybe in the 30s.
Oh, really? While you owned the mill property down there, did you own any lumber property or in the surrounding area?
Not in Malone, no.
Oh, or in the county?
Mm-hmm. No, I think nearly everything at that time, Dad owned Cherry Hill lots and other what we call wild land up between Scary and Lake Titus Road and up through there he owned some. And then those were sold to the state when they bought wild land because they had all been lumbered. Mm-hmm. And at one period, and I would say maybe it was in the 30s that the state was buying up wild land for conservation purposes, and they bought that.
But he never owned, after he owned the mill down here, he never owned timberland elsewhere.
Most of the time we just bought from the owners, and we just buy the logging rights. We bought down at Athelstan, I know that we had rights for that, and sent it up some by railroad cars in Canada. And then we bought up above Saranac Lake, and that was chucked down mostly by cars, and then taken across the boat on the ice. And then at McCollum's, up as you go up toward Meacham, we numbered that. And Twin Ponds, which is Will Clark's up near Long Pond, which is Long Pond now, and it's in there, and different places. And then we tried to buy as much as we could, and there were a lot of farmers and other people who owned land who would cut logs and then deliver them to the mill for, we paid by the thousand for them. Whenever they'd bring in a load, we would scale it and pay them for the logs they delivered. And they were coming in, we couldn't tell when, but they'd be coming in all the time and be unloaded whenever they came. But they would.
They would bring in the rough logs?
Uh-huh.
Were they doing this well into the 1960s, until the mill closed, bringing in the rough logs?
Mm-hmm. Well, we would tell them how they had to be cut. For instance, if you had a 12-foot log, it had to be cut at least 12 feet 2 inches so it could be trimmed, and 14 feet 2 and like that, 16. And then when we needed a lot more, they would be very likely to want to cut 12-foot ones because it was easier to draw them. They weren't so heavy and cumbersome on the load. But you see, we needed more 14s and 16s, especially 16-foot because you got 8-foot studs and things like that. So that we would have to, at times, specify what we were in need of.
Mm-hmm. Would you call them, or would they call you and offer to?
Well, they'd call us usually to see if they could sell them, if they cut them. And then we would tell them what.
What was the main kind of wood they would bring in?
Well, usually spruce and hemlock. There's more, I think, but there was some hardwood all the time. I mean, in their stand of spruce or hemlock, they'd find birch and elm. They'd also take elm and maple, another different kind of hardwood. And unless we had reached a saturation point,